Hello, everyone. Welcome to our The Week That Was in Europe podcast. My name is Dirk Schumacher. I'm the head of European macro research at Natixis. And with me, as usual, is Klaus Adam, professor of economics at the University of Mannheim.
Hello, also from my side. So today we will talk about money growth in the euro area, in particular about what we can learn from money growth for output and inflation going forward. Money growth has received renewed interest among economists recently, as growth rates have sharply slowed down in recent months and even become negative for some monetary aggregates. We will discuss the various angles from which one can look at money growth and what these growth rates imply. A key question that we'll look at is whether the slowdown in money growth rates that we have seen should affect the outlook of inflation and economic activity or not. But before discussing these issues, let's have a brief look at the latest European macro data, Dirk.
Yeah, so at time of recording, Friday early morning, we only have so far the French GDP numbers, but we'll get later today other GDP data from other countries. But the French GDP numbers came in line with expectations. So the economy expanded by 0.2 on the quarter. And we already had yesterday also the Belgium numbers, all suggesting that the euro area grew a bit at the beginning of the year. So defying expectations that it would slide into recessions. Those expectations obviously date back from the energy price shock. So that's good news, and we'll have again more data to discuss then next week. But let's move on now to money.
Yeah, we talked already last week about liquidity with our guest Olivier Hubert. The focus then was on how a bank manages its liquidity portfolio to make sure that it can pay at all times. This week, we want to talk again about liquidity, but in a much broader sense. Rather than looking at an individual bank and its liquidity operations, we want to look at the amount of liquidity that is available for the aggregate economy. In particular, we'd like to analyze to what extent changes in the amount of aggregate money is a signal that is informative about the direction of output and inflation going forward. We look at this question both from a theoretical and an empirical perspective.
The notion that money changes in the volume of money provides some signal about how real activity inflation would develop going forward is anything but new. For instance, in 1752, David Hume argued in his essay of Money that there is a proportional relationship between the amount of money and the level of prices. In fact, this postulated relationship between money growth and price growth is also enshrined in the so-called quantity theory of money, arguably one of the oldest economic theories still around.
That's right. So the quantity theory of money states that the stock of money times the velocity at which money circulates in the economy is equal to the nominal value of goods that get produced in the economy. And the idea behind this relationship is quite simple. Everything that gets produced in the economy needs to be sold and paid for by some form of money. Therefore, the stock of money multiplied by the number of times money circulates per unit of time must equal the nominal value of goods that get produced in the economy over the considered unit of time. And the nominal value of goods consists of what? Well, it consists of the real quantity of goods that get produced times the nominal price at which these goods sell. And sometimes this simple relationship is summarized by an equation of the form M times V is equal to P times Y, where M stands for money, V for the velocity of money, P for the price level, and Y for real output. So once again, M times V, money times velocity, is equal to P times Y, the price level times output. And in fact, at the so-called Constance Seminar, which is a conference series that was founded by the famous monetary economist Karl Brunner, and which takes place every year at the Lake of Constance in Germany, there is a rainbow-colored flag in the seminar room with this equation written onto it. It says M times V is equal P times Y on the flag. I think it's there to remind everybody of Karl Brunner, who has been the person that coined the term monetarism.
Yeah, economists are known for being sentimental. Well, but as old as theories of relationship between money and prices may be, they have also been met early on with skepticism. Some have argued, for instance, that the quantity theory isn't even a theory, but only an accounting identity. In the end, the quantity theory features four variables: money, velocity of money, the price level, and output. But there's only one equation. How can one equation determine four variables? Well, it can't. So the theory is severely incomplete.
Yeah, in fact, this is where some of the troubles start, because one can have very different perspectives on the quantity theory equation in terms of what it determines and what it takes as given. One possible view is that the quantity theory is an equation to determine simply the velocity of money. That means that an increase in money would have no effect on output and prices, but only lead to an inverse proportional reduction in money velocity. So M, money goes up, say because of central bank actions, then V, velocity goes down, so that M times V remains constant, and as a result, neither output or inflation must move. And there are, in fact, periods in the recent past in which this view was empirically plausible. For instance, during the pre-pandemic period, where nominal interest rates were basically zero, during this period, central banks injected large amounts of money via asset purchases, but by and large moved neither output nor prices, which in fact means that the money injections simply caused a reduced money velocity.
An alternative view on the quantity theory is one that assumes that money increased by the central bank action do affect money velocity and also do not affect output. Then the quantity theory equation implies that money increases lead to a proportionate increase in the price level. This is the view that was expressed by David Hume in the 18th century. And this view also has its merits. In fact, there's quite some reasonable, good international evidence that long-run money growth and long-run inflation are tightly linked, especially when considering relative high rates of money growth.
Yeah, so that would be a situation where the quantity equation establishes a relationship between money and prices. But in the short run, things can look quite differently. If prices do not move a lot in the short run, which is plausible for most periods, then an injection of money into the economy could lead to an increase in output instead of an increase in prices, at least if we now continue to assume that velocity doesn't move. The quantity theory then stipulates a relationship between money growth and output growth, rather than between money growth and price growth, that is inflation. What all this shows is that you have to make sure you understand the perspective other people take on the quantity theory equation when you try to talk to them about it. What is it that they take as given, and what variable do they believe is going to be determined by the quantity theory? Otherwise, these sort of conversations about the quantity theory can become very confusing very quickly.
Yeah, there's no shortage of confusing conversations these days, so let's rather not have them. So, but how can we make sense of all this? Well, one must have clear understanding of which variable responds to money at which horizon. And there's a clear distinction between the short and long run implications of a change in the amount of money, something that Nobel Prize winner Robert Lucas discussed in his Nobel lecture titled Money Neutrality. On the one hand, most economists adhere to the view that in the long run, money injections do not affect output and thus must be reflected in higher prices, simply because the long-run prospects of an economy cannot be changed by the number of pieces of paper or electronic bookkeeping entries floating around in the economy. Thus, the consensus is that in the long run, prices increase if the stock of money is increased.
Yet in the short run, prices do not move by a lot, they are sticky. And as a result, a change in the amount of money can have real effects in the short term and lead to higher output and employment. Again, provided one is willing to entertain the assumption that velocity doesn't change as a result of the money injection. In fact, modern monetary models virtually all reconcile short-term real effects of money with long-run neutrality of money for output, so that money moves in the long run only prices, but leaves output unaffected. This suggests that money changes could in principle be a predictor for inflation in the long term, and possibly also a predictor for output in the short term.
This also assumes that money velocity is reasonably constant over time. If money velocity were to fluctuate widely, then the predictive power of money growth for both output and inflation would, according to the quantity theory itself, be severely reduced. It is thus an empirical question whether or not money growth is really useful predictor of these variables. In fact, money velocity isn't constant over time. It generally trends downward over time and can sometimes also fluctuate noticeably over short horizons, as we'll discuss later in this podcast.
So let's speak now about the empirical relationship between money growth, price growth, that is inflation, and output growth. When seeking to understand whether money growth predicts inflation or output, one has to make a choice about which monetary aggregate to look at. And in fact, the question, what is money, has no simple or straightforward answer. If we simply focus on the transaction character of money as being something I can pay my bills with, there are obviously many ways you can pay the bills. And what counts as money also depends on the way the financial system works and evolves over time.
Another complicating factor is that money can not only be used for buying goods and services, but also for buying existing financial and real assets, that is stocks, bonds, or real estate. From a theory perspective, however, only purchases of new goods and services would be relevant for the output and the price level. Yet, disentangling money used for purchases of new goods from money used for purchases of existing goods is impossible. So one will have to settle from the viewpoint of the theory with a rather imperfect measure of aggregate money.
Yeah, and generally what is used in empirical analysis as a broad notion of money, in particular, the so-called M3 money measure, which is computed by the ECB. M3 contains, broadly speaking, the stock of all liquid assets with a maturity of up to 2 years. This includes, in particular, cash that is in circulation, bills and coins, overnight deposits that the private sector holds at commercial banks, time deposits and debt securities with a maturity up to 2 years, money market funds and so-called repurchase agreements, and a few other things. Now, let's see how this M3 measure of money has evolved in the euro area over time and how it relates to output and inflation and whether it's useful at all in predicting those.
And let's start with the relationship between money growth and inflation that David Hume already speculated about in the 18th century. In the euro area, the correlation between annual growth rates of M3 and core inflation since 1985 is 0.31. Just to make this a bit clearer, a correlation of 1 would imply that both series move in complete lockstep. A correlation of 0 would imply no linear co-movement at all. So a correlation of 0.31 is not exactly 0, but at the same time, a far cry from 1. What this means is that over the relative short time horizon of 1 year, money is not really a great predictor of inflation. Note that we already use core inflation here, that is inflation which excludes energy and food, so to filter out some of the exogenous price shocks of the past that come from the oil sector or from agriculture.
Now, if we look at a somewhat longer horizon, then the situation gets somewhat better. For instance, if one considers a five-year moving average of core inflation, and similarly a five-year moving average of M3 money growth, then the correlation between money growth and inflation increases to a respectable 0.65. This suggests that at longer horizons, the information content of money growth with respect to inflation developments increases. Well, but a caveat is that this does not imply that other variables, say interest rates or wages, couldn't do a better job at predicting inflation. So it doesn't really prove yet that money is special in terms of predicting inflation. But let's leave this aspect out for the moment.
It also has to be said that the correlation between money growth and core inflation, even when looking at five-year moving averages, is not really stable over time. There are longer periods over which the correlation is actually quite low. For example, five-year money growth steadily increased in the run-up to the 2009 financial crisis, reaching a level of close to 10% in early 2009. Yet core inflation barely moved prior or after the financial crisis.
Yes, and one possible reason why the relationship between money growth and inflation can be unstable, even at longer horizons, is that the velocity of money fails to be constant. One can actually check whether money velocity varies over time. And the simple way to compute money velocity is to divide nominal GDP by the stock of M3 money. And according to this measure of velocity, velocity stood at 0.38 at the beginning of 1995. What does this mean? Well, it means that about 38% of outstanding M3 was required to purchase quarterly GDP at the start of 1995. Now, if we move to the end, the last quarter of 2022, velocity stood at 21%, meaning that in 2022, only 21% of M3 was required to purchase quarterly GDP. And between 1995 and 2022, velocity displayed quite a steady downward trend, so wasn't constant at all.
Yet there were some hiccups in between, with velocity dropping suddenly faster. That was the case around the 2009 financial crisis, and then again during the initial phase of the COVID pandemic. And the letter suggests that the relationship between money and inflation becomes particularly unreliable during these crisis times.
So to sum up, what can we learn from all this? The value of money growth for predicting inflation is there, but only at relatively long horizons, such as 5 years. And even then, the relationship between money growth and inflation is relatively unstable, especially during crisis times. And not to speak of the issue that maybe the incremental value of money hasn't been established, because there could be other much better predictors, perhaps for long-term inflation.
Yeah, let's now move on and have a look at the relationship between money growth and economic growth. If prices and the velocity of money are sticky in the short run, so they don't move much, and if the quantity theory is right, well, then there should be a relationship between short-run money growth and GDP growth. Unfortunately, this is not something that we see in the data. The correlation, again, between a yearly M3 money growth and yearly GDP growth is essentially 0.08. This clearly signals that money growth is not a useful predictor for growth in economic activity.
Yeah, that's quite disappointing. But as a final step, we will now have a look at the latest money growth numbers and what they may imply for inflation going forward. We have to emphasize that all this needs to be taken with a grain of salt, particularly around crisis times like the recent pandemic period. The signals coming from changes in the money stock for inflation can become particularly unreliable, partly due to velocity changes, as we've discussed above. And what have we seen is that money growth increased sharply during the early phase of the pandemic. with an annual growth rate reaching close to 12%. Subsequently, there was a pronounced deceleration in money growth. That's what everyone talks about now, with the latest M3 growth rate standing at just 3.2%. That's almost a 9% drop relative to the peak of the pandemic money growth. That's quite a sharp drop, and even exceeds the drop that we have seen during, that is only exceeded by the drop that we have seen during the 2009 financial crisis.
So what can we now infer from these wild movements of M3 money growth? For one, such wild swings are not unusual during crisis times, and they probably predominantly reflect the wish of private households and companies to increase their liquidity, that is their cash holdings. During the early phase of the pandemic, it was highly uncertain how things would play out. So it's understandable that many companies and households had a desire to increase liquidity buffer. This was just a very reasonable thing to do. In some sense, the pandemic uncertainty created a huge money demand shock, which manifested itself in a large drop in money velocity because the money wasn't spent.
The fact that monetary aggregates are now growing less sharply and that at the same time, money velocity is rising again suggests that the private sector sees less of a need to prepare itself against significant adverse shocks. Whether this deceleration of money growth has implications in terms of future inflation being lower or higher is rather questionable. Higher money growth can be offset by lower velocity, as happened during the start of the pandemic. And now, lower money growth can be offset by rising velocity, as we currently observe. According to the quantity theory, this is largely consistent with money growth fluctuations having then no impact on either inflation and GDP.
And to sum up, money matters. There is information in money movements of monetary aggregates, but it's not always clear what that signal is, and one has to be very careful in distilling that and looking, depending on which horizon one thinks. So the drop in money growth we see now does not imply that the inflation threat is over, so to speak. It's obviously welcome. It's a good sign. It's a sign of normalization. But things are more complicated when discussing the inflation outlook, as we've done on several times on this podcast. Let's leave it there and talk to you again next week, Klaus.